Everybody, and welcome to minute 92 of season 5 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1990 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard 2, Die Harder, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is Mark Hoffmeyer from Movies, Films, and Flicks, and from both the Deep Blue Sea podcast and the Con Air pod. Welcome back to the show, Mark.
I want some mashed potatoes right now. I am hungry. All this fake snow in this chapter is making me hungry for mashed potatoes, Movie Rob.
And why not? You know, it makes
sense. I've never been on a film set where mashed potatoes were used, and I wish I could. I wish I could be on one of those sets.
What do you mean? You just like pick it up and start eating it like normal? Like you'd be eating snow or something like that?
No, I
you know,
just,
like
someone
super,
who
like Clark Kent does when he's on his way up to the North Pole, you know, just you see him eating snow on the side of the road.
As someone who just likes film, I would like to see the consistency of the potatoes and how they look on set. And I would also like to see how they work in hot temperature, because it would just melt and you have potatoes everywhere. So it seems like a high risk, high reward gamble to put potatoes down, mashed potato flakes. When you need fake snow. And I like it. High risk, high reward. Good job, Renny Harlin.
do they still use them in movies, you think?
Yeah, of course.
Because I mean, they look bad. I mean, I know that like in the 40s they used them a lot. They would actually bleach them.
I mean, listen, foam looks like crap. Paper looks okay, but sometimes it looks... I think paper works okay in places like Antarctica, where it's just a frozen wall, where, you know, like get some foam, spray paint it, and when nothing melts. But in a world like this, I think mashed potatoes are best because they can still melt. They still look decent with water. The consistency's right. If you just use paper, paper kind of looks fake and it doesn't stick good.
Right.
Paper, like you know fake snow when you see paper. It just doesn't look right. And you know foam, too. You're like, oh, man, that's foam on the person's head. So, yeah, I think Napoleon Dynamite would be proud of, of tomato potatoes as fake snow.
Okay, that's fair. So minute 92 begins with the snowmobile coming in from the distance and ends with Stuart beginning to load up his gun.
Ooh.
So yesterday we ended things with, you know, John has killed two more of the henchmen and he is now riding a snowmobile like he is John Wayne. Yeah.
Literally. Like I know you. It's from the past episode.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, first of all, the opening shot of this minute is great because it's the camera's just standing in one spot and then we have the snowmobile fly by it, you know, like come closer and fly by. But I mean, I think they used way too much water here. You know, it looks like he's goes back to what we were talking about yesterday. It looks like he's jet skiing. It does not look like he's completely snow skiing.
Oh, no. Yeah, this is bad here. Way too much water.
And then the water like splashes out at the camera, you know.
and I think this shows a fatal flaw of snowmobile chases is that you can tell that these snowmobiles are not going fast. And there's several shots that linger on the snowmobiles driving for at least 10 to 12 seconds.
Yeah.
And one thing really interesting that I learned about filming chases was on Top Gun Maverick. And I studied that movie as much as I could. And what they did on Top Gun Maverick was airplanes in the air. They don't look great because it's just they're in the air. You have no idea about how fast they're going. So they put it in the trench and they put cameras low on the ground to show the speed of the planes and to show the planes going past trees, past canyons, past other things that you could compare. So when you watch... You know, if they're just in the air, you're like, I have no concept of how fast this is. But if you put some things on the ground or say cars and they blast past them, you're like, oh, I have a reference for how fast this is going. So there are several wide shots in this, like where when McClane's catching up to them, like it's a legitimate 12 seconds and he's moving pretty slow. But I think the best shot in this comes at 28 when they blast past the camera and whatever it is, the smoke or whatever they lay down shoots up, it gives you a real sense of the speed. And I think that's the best shot of this chase that actually makes you feel some at like 28 through 30. Looks great. Wow. But then they spend 6 seconds having a plane catch up, but it still looks good because it's on the ground and it gives them a reference for how fast it's going.
Yeah.
So I think that's the best shot in this minute. And I know we have to get there.
No, but we're pretty much there because there isn't much that goes on here. Yeah. I mean, this is a minute where it's just, you know, it's funny that the script mentioned yesterday, you know, the fact that it looks like he's on a horse, because it really does look like someone who's on a horse that's chasing, you know, someone else who's on a horse. That's more or less what's going on here. You know, he's and we never really know the exact distance between, you know, Stewart and you know, the four guys that are left alive there. You know, you got Stewart, Miller, Khan, and Esperanza. You know, we don't know how far ahead of John they really are, because they never give us an established shot of, you know, John and them in the same frame. It's either they show us John and John is like huffing and puffing trying to get to them, or you see them and they're running away from John, you know, that type of thing. And that's pretty much how this whole minute is. I mean, you just keep the shot keeps changing between them and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, something we see Esperanza turn around at one point and look worried, you know, oh, he's catching up. You know, it's like, but we don't really know if he is catching up or not.
And I think the studio work isn't great on this as well. As much as I love Rennie Harlan and never want to insult his name, the studio shots do not add too much to it. And you're right, they're never really in the same frame, so there's really no reference on how far away he is. Yeah, because he's way back. You know, if I was... Well, there's actually at 22, we see him kind of far back. He's probably, what, 30 yards behind them? Which doesn't make sense later, because that guy still has time to turn around.
That's right. Miller.
And drive at him for several seconds.
That's right.
So the geography's all over the place on this one. And I think, you know, we still have to understand that Rennie, it's cold. Rennie was still quite inexperienced. And jet skis, like, you know, True Lies, the snowmobile. If I say jet ski, I just think I'm saying snowmobile. In True Lies, I think the snowmobile scene works so well, because they're going past trees. There's a sense of danger there. So I think, and a lot of the Bond films too, I think they do a good job of keeping the camera close. Because I think a jet ski in a wide shot isn't the sexiest thing.
Right.
Just seeing it putz along the snow. So I like to think that maybe Rennie Harlan learned some lessons about action scenes while working on this. Because this minute's not... I don't want to hate. I'm not hating. But if you just watch this on your own, you probably wouldn't. I don't know.
You'd say this is a really boring movie. What's going on here?
Right? Like,
that's the problem. Like, it's just a chase. This is a chase scene. That's all it is.
Mm-hmm. But there's no car. There's no other snowmobiles on the road. Right? There's no.
That's right.
There's not like commuters coming home on snowmobiles in this scene. And like, there's a trucker snowmobile guy going, whoa! Like, it's just bare roads. And I would have maybe sped up the frame rate a little bit, make them seem faster, get the camera closer. Right. I mean, they have Charlie Passerni there, who, I mean, that dude worked on everything. Like, that guy could strap a camera to anything and shoot it. So maybe it was just the time that they ran out of, but I do love the shot. If like the, at what did I say? 28 seconds.
Yeah.
Like, that looks really cool.
And the music, that's a really the music good in this minute is also great. Because it like tries to raise the tension of what's going on, you know, with the you know what Michael came in did here, you know, it's just great.
And I think this scene could have been 20 seconds, right? The good score, cut to that really cool shot with the camera on the ground, and then have Sadler be like, "Yo, dude, go get him."
Exactly.
And then that's the scene.
Exactly. I agree. You know, but then we wouldn't have a minute to talk about here. So
you're right. And I'm not hating. I requested this, but I think this is good because it showcases the pitfalls of snowmobile cinema.
That's right.
Like you need to have that. I think even Inception 2, there's a danger because they're going downhill. There's a lot of armed guards. He uses a snowmobile to cut the wires off of Tom Hardy does. Like it's Inception. That movie's about 90% explaining.
I think you just need to go to like A View to a Kill and just have Beach Boys, you know, and that's it. Yeah. You know, that's the way you do it.
Embrace the absurdity of it, right?
That's right.
Or even Triple X. There is, he's on skis, but then there's villains on snowmobiles, but they get taken over by an avalanche.
Right.
Like that's how you, that's like, I think snowmobiles on their own aren't the greatest, but if you add trees and avalanche
and skiers,
zombies and skiers with machine guns and you're three levels down into a dream,
there you go.
Then you got it.
That's right.
Yeah.
Sorry. That, it makes sense. I don't think
Rennie was there yet.
I think it makes sense. You know, he didn't come up with that concept yet. You know, yet that.
But still.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things.
Snowmobile action scene.
I mean, you've listened to the commentary on this movie. So Rennie says so many times that a lot of the scenes in this movie, everyone will look at nowadays and say, oh, everyone does this. But they don't realize that he was the first to do it here. You know, that's what's amazing about it. How he keeps telling us that, you know, and it's easy to believe, but it's hard to visualize. Because we've been inundated over the last 33 years with so many movies that use these same type of tropes of action scenes, and to say, well, you know, Die Hard 2 was the first one that did these things. But, you know, it's great thinking about the fact that Rennie was the one who did it.
And listen, that's what I love about Rennie Harlan, first and foremost. And that's why I always get annoyed when people kind of insult Rennie Harlan or call him a hack. I was just watching a documentary called Sharksploitation, and it's on Shudder right now. It's about the history of shark cinema. And by the time they got to Deep Blue Sea, they have nothing. Like, I'm telling you, filmmakers, film historians, PhDs, writers, they have nothing but love for Deep Blue Sea, because it gleefully takes Jurassic Park and Jaws, and it puts kitchen fights in. Like, I have shark fights, a shark fights somebody in a kitchen. Like, Rennie Harlan is the king of seeing, like, hey, I saw something new. Like in Long Kiss Goodnight, which is another great Cole Rennie Harlan film. Mm-hmm. She is on ice skates chasing down a car. There's a car chase with her on ice skates. I think that, and he wisely gives jets, snowmobiles a very minimal of screen time as well, which works. But he's a guy who in Cliffhanger has Stallone, the beginning. Let's think about the beginning. When they're on the rope, or they had a guy go from an airplane to another airplane for real.
Yes.
For real. Mm-hmm. In Cliffhanger.
Yeah.
And the finale of Cliffhanger, it's two people fighting each other on an upside down helicopter on the side of a cliff that's attached to a staircase.
Yes.
Like Rennie Harlan is a guy, even prison, even Nightmare on Elm Street 4, he is a man who will go to incredible lengths to give audiences something that they haven't seen before. I feel like in every single Rennie Harlan movie you watch, there's going to be something that you go, wow, that was cool. Like, he's that guy. Even Cutthroat Island, which bums me out that it wasn't, people hate it so much. The final fight between Gina Davis and, oh man, I forget his name, but the guy, it's incredible. Like, they're on top of a boat sword fighting and they're actually there. So, I know I'm hating on snowmobile action scenes, but this is a guy with the ejection seat and that explosion. I mean, that's iconic.
Yes.
They drop a dude from a helicopter onto a plane. I know you're not there yet, but like Rennie said in the commentary, like he says many times, I did this first. And people need to respect that. It annoys me.
No, I agree. I mean, you just were talking before about the, you know, in Cliffhanger, how they use, you know, the wire to go across, the zip line to go across. Yeah. Okay. Oh. Now, okay, you think about that in the movie and stuff like that, and then, you know, 4 years later, they did Air Force One, where they do that again, and they do it great. But when you think about it now, you know, you don't make the connection. It takes a while to make the connection, saying, oh, wait a second, Cliffhanger did this 4 years ago. You know, it doesn't diminish how great it is in Air Force One, because Air Force One has them doing a zipline as the plane is descending and is about to crash. So it's a little different.
Yeah. I mean, they still did it. And listen, when you go back to the beginning of cinema, I mean, they did a trip to the moon. Now there's like, there's the great train robbery. Mm-hmm. There's the creature, Universal creature features. There's the pre-code gangster films. There's Scarface that was made pre-code. I mean, Nosferatu got made because the guy couldn't get credit. He couldn't get the Dracula, Bram Stoker's Dracula, so he switched his name to Count Orlok. So
that's right.
I think I look at movies, right, is like any sports game, any chess match, anything where, like, it's the same concept, right? You go to a soccer game and it's eight different teams. The ball still gets kicked. You score goals. There's offsides. Most of the teams have a striker. Some don't. Some have a false nine. But there's still the same rules. There's no handballs, but every game is different. So I'm totally cool with more movies borrowing.
Yeah, I mean, of course.
Look at Tarantino. Like, look at Rennie and Jurassic Park. Like, you do pay homage to these films, but it's, yeah, I don't, but like you said, when I watch Air Force One, I'm like, this movie rocks.
That's right. Exactly.
This movie is great. And you know what? It's kind of nice. Like I did it. I was one of the people who did it first, but he also borrows elements from his films for other,
yeah, of course,
from other.
Well, they all do. You know, it's just, but the idea is to borrow and change it a little bit to make it still unique on your own.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think the John Wick guys have been great at that, right?
Yeah,
like,
for sure.
They Enter the Dragon, they ripped off. Not ripped off. Enter the Dragon, Skyfall, Villainess. Like, they find scenes they like and they recreate them in a different way.
That's right.
And that's what cinema is. Like, it's, you know, people pattern their play after Kobe. People pattern their play after Jordan. People pattern their play after Isaiah Thomas.
Right.
You can be your own. But yeah, I say this every time I talk about Rennie Harlan. I get so, like, people just want to brush this guy off, but he's a dude from Finland. And you've talked about this, Born American,
yeah,
where on DBS, where this guy hustled, man. This guy didn't have the nepotistic.
No.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, he didn't have a rich uncle in the States. Like, he just showed up with his long locks, had a movie, pitched it, made Prison, made Nightmare on Elm Street 4. Like, this is a guy who worked his way up and got to the top. Like, not the top of the world. Well, yeah, he made the largest budgeted film
that's
ever.
Right.
So,
at the same time that he was,
that's what I
and
love
he
about
was,
him.
And don't forget, he was making two movies at the exact same time. You know, he was doing Ford Fairlane at the same time that he's doing this one. You know, obviously, it's heaven and earth between the two of them, completely very far.
Mm-hmm.
Apart, but still,
yeah, Andrew Dice Clay, but I mean, there's still some good shark stuff. Robert Englund's good in it,
yes,
so that makes me happy. But it's you know, this scene, I know I kind of talked about the snowmobile stuff, but I think he learned from it later. Like, you could see how he's learned throughout his career and adapted, and I can't tell you how happy I was to see Deep Blue Sea getting so much love on that documentary.
I gotta watch it. It sounds really interesting. I gotta watch it. I'll let you know what I think.
They go back to the early 19. Yeah, they go back to the early 1900s and talk about early shark cinema. It's really great.
Wow.
I love it. And Roger Corman, and it's so cool.
Oh, wow. All right. You got me sold on that one. I'm going to go watch that tonight. Maybe tomorrow. We'll see. Good.
I know it doesn't have anything to do with Die Hard 2.
It doesn't have to. Great.
And Rennie Harlan.
It doesn't
Harlan's
have to, you know. You know, it's you know, we one of the things that we all like doing is talking about movies, and we love talking about movies that we love. And, you know, you and Jay love Deep Blue Sea and Con Air much more than I do. But that doesn't negate the fact that I still enjoy those movies. And, you know, if you tell me that you saw a documentary that talks, you know, exclusively about it, it talks about sharks in movies, so why not check it out? You know, there's no reason not to.
That's so good. And
For me, you know, spending an hour and a half, 2 hours watching any movie is time well spent, especially when it's recommended.
Shark exploitation, what's making
that's right. Good. Especially when it's recommended by a good friend. So why not?
That's right. And I have a question. You've probably talked about it, but what do you feel about the action films of 1990? Like, what's your... There's not much happens in this chapter. So, I mean, we can... sorry, if you want to cover the chapter, then talk about it. But, like, what's like, your 1990s... Like, if you had to do a film...
Wait, you're talking about just 1990, or you're talking about throughout the entire...
1990, like, one year, 1990, and you had to pick three action films for or action-adjacent films for a film festival. Which three would you
pick? Okay, am I allowed to pick Die Hard 2 or not?
Yeah, of course.
All right, so in no particular order, that's actually a very simple question to answer. You know, so you got this movie.
Ooh, let's hear it.
You got Total Recall, right? Those are definitely my top two for that one. And the question is whether I don't know. Can Goodfellas be considered an action movie? I don't know. Maybe not. Probably not. No.
Right? I mean, there's death and stabbings and stuff, but I wouldn't call it an action picture.
No, that's fair. All right. So what else would I want to put in that one from 1990? I mean, those two were within a second. I knew that those two were on that list. I mean, I liked Hard to Kill, but I don't know if that really is that far up. Okay, how about Hunt for Red October? There you go.
Ooh, I'm covering that on MFF with Norbert Morvan sometime soon. So that's a great picture there.
Yeah, so those would be my three. What would be your three?
So I immediately thought of Tremors, Total Recall, and Die Hard 2. But then I also thought, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to do three 1990 movies that people might not have watched too much. I'm going to take Red Surf, which is, it has George Clooney, and it's a crime caper with jet ski action in it. I'm going to take Red Surf. I'm going to do Firebirds, the Nick Cage Apache helicopter movie.
I hated it. It's terrible.
Where he just screams, "I'm the greatest. I'm the greatest. I'm the greatest." And the coup de grace is Dark Angel, or I Come in Peace, starring Dolph Lundgren.
Okay, yeah, where I've seen that.
He has to stop intergalactic drug dealers from coming to Earth and stealing people's bodily
fluids. You just talked about that.
Turning them
you
into
just talked
drugs
about that on
planet.
The finale of Con Air.
Yeah, and then Lambcast, I was a guest on that, so I covered that. So I'll say I Come in Peace, Firebirds, and Red Surf. Just so everyone can be like, what are you showing me? And why are we not watching Die Hard 2?
Well, my number. Yeah, that's my. I just realized what my number four would be though on that list. So that, you know, I just gave you the top three with Hunt for October, Total Recall, and Die Hard 2. Number four has got to be Navy SEALs. Navy SEALs was such a. It's a stupid movie, but it is so much fun. You know, and seeing Charlie Sheen in an action role like that is just great. You know, like when he jumps
Charlie
out.
Charlie Sheen, Michael.
Yeah,
Bean, right.
When Charlie Sheen just jumps out of the Jeep. You know, and dives off the bridge. That's just nuts.
So are you changing it? Or are you sticking with your original three?
I'm sticking with it. Yeah, you can't.
I mean, you picked a way better. Yeah. I think people would be angry at me for coming to my film festival. But.
Yeah, I think.
I'm still.
Yeah.
I don't know. I it's fun. I'm happy with the movies.
Good.
I pick,
that's so. Important. That's very important, Mark. You need to be happy with the movies you pick. Yeah. You know,
I am the greatest. Have you seen Red Surf?
Red Surf is I Come in Peace. That's what you're saying? Or no?
Oh. No. Red Surf is the George Clooney crime caper.
I've never
Not
seen
very
that.
Good.
Should I waste an hour and a half watching that one?
Well, can you background watch
I could background I could if I wanted to.
Yeah, I would background it.
All right.
I would do that. It's surfers and drug dealers Remar and Attila are in the process of setting up a deal with a local drug lord, Calavera, when their friend Tom True Blue is busted by the cops. Blue says too much while in custody, and Calavera sets out for revenge.
All right, well, I gotta disappoint you a little bit, but on IMDb that's 1989. Not 1990, but you know, I will still check it out.
All right, good. Well, it does say 89, but why does it say 90 on my thing? Wait, on Mubi it says 90.
I don't know.
Let me see the release date. I'm sticking with it.
No, but a release date again. IMDb goes according to if it was in a film festival, and that you know, so that would be the release date. So it doesn't, you know, that doesn't help from that perspective.
I'm changing the rules. A theatrical release or a TV release, not just one.
Yeah, it had a video premiere in December 89 in Sweden. Okay, I have a feeling that's just complete bullshit. No, that's my guess. Because, you know, it was in the Houston Film Festival on April 21st, 1990 in the U.S. I have a very, very
there it is.
Hard time believing that it came out on video in 1989 in Sweden. You know, I don't know. I know that I can go into IMDb and correct that, but you know, I don't think I don't really. It's not that important.
I paid a bunch of money for the Red Surf vinegar syndrome thing too, so I got to recommend it. I got to play it somewhere. Also, this is really random, but I just bought Johnny Mnemonic in black and white. I bought a cut of Johnny Mnemonic. You know, sometimes you got to live on the edge, my friend.
Okay, that's true. And
I'm actually starting a Dolph Lundgren. So on MFF, every 25th episode, we do Kurt Russell. Now, every 26th episode, it's like 126, you know, like yada, yada. We are doing a Dolph Lundgren
episode. Okay.
So
all right.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Just, you know, he's not that good in Creed, but whatever. That's
Ooh, Dolphy's so good at that finale when they're smiling and running.
Oh. Nah, I still like that. You know, I'll still go with him and you know, Rocky IV director's cut. That would be my guess.
Oh yeah, that's
that'd be my pick there.
Well, that's a movie. Have you seen the hour and a half long documentary about Sylvester Stallone cutting the director's cut? It's an hour and a half on YouTube. Wow. And he just talks about the mistakes he made and why he did
the mistakes he made then, or the mistakes he made now.
It's very honest. Then and why he's fixing it now. It's very open. It's very honest. And if you're kind of into film and editing, I think you'll dig it.
Oh wow! All right, I will definitely check that out too. See, there you go. You keep giving me more and more things to watch.
I just like documentaries because for podcast prep, I like to hear from their own, like director's own words. You know,
I completely agree with you on that. I love documentaries. Some of them are great. All right, so let's get a little bit back to Die Hard 2. We do have a little bit more to talk about in this minute. So at a certain point, you know, we see Stewart also looks back, you know, at John, who, based on Stewart's reaction on his face, John's getting a little closer, but we can't really see that, you know, by looking at the screen. And then he turns and screams, "Miller, take him. I'll cover you," which it makes no sense whatsoever, but okay. So
I'll cover you.
Exactly. So I've actually never thought about this even before when we mentioned the character of Miller, you know, who's played by Vondi Curtis Hall, right? And do you know that Miller is the seventh most common surname in the U.S.? I never really thought about that. What would you think would be the first six?
Smith, Jones, well, I don't know. That's Smith and Diaz.
No. Okay. Smith and Jones are definitely there. So first of all, one out of every 25 Americans is named either Smith, Johnson, Williams, Brown, Jones, Miller, or Davis. Those are the top ones. Yeah, that's just crazy. And did you know that it is the most common Amish surname? Which I never thought about that one.
Jones?
No, not Jones. Miller.
Oh, Miller.
Miller.
Well, they're Millers, right?
Well, it comes from the Swiss name Mueller.
A lot of Swedish.
Swedish Amish people. So Miller does a really cool stunt after he's given this order by Stewart. I mean, he finds a way to actually spin his snowmobile around. You know, he doesn't turn it around. He doesn't stop.
Yeah, that
he
was just, cool.
He
just like
turns, you know, he turns the handlebars, you know, to the left and just does like a 180 while he's doing that, which is pretty cool that the stuntman was able to do that. And then we get a shot where we can actually see the skid marks that he makes, you know, because we see a shot of Khan and Esperanza, you know, riding. So we see right behind them the circular skid marks. I guess it's from let's hope it's from Miller and not from like some crew member or something like that. And then the two snowmobiles that are still leading, they both slow down and, you know, they find a really, really low area to hide behind. They have this like little tree, which you can't really,
Yeah.
it's not doing much camouflage good here. But they pull
No,
over to the
not at
side,
all.
and then Miller is still apparently charging at John, but we'll have to wait until tomorrow to find out exactly what he's doing. And then we see John start coming. Sorry, actually, we see one of the this we see a snowmobile coming, and we don't know if it's John or Miller because they're shooting. It's in the distance. We don't know.
Yeah.
And then Stuart, they get a shot of Stuart standing up. Now, I mentioned the fact on Friday that everyone else has like hats and what are they called? Bavlakavas,
Oh,
balaclavas, right?
balaclavas.
The ski masks. But Stuart's the only one who doesn't, so that we always can recognize him. He's got to have just the goggles, the goggles and the hair, so this way we know it's him. So he turns around and like picks up his gun, and we see that he is starting to take out the blue magazine, which I gotta tell you, it's a little strange that they hadn't switched their guns at this point. I mean, when they were in the church, we saw that they all put in blue from red, but you'd think when they're on the run, they would change that in order to, why
Yeah.
keep riding with, I mean, even the 2 seconds as you're getting on the snowmobile, get on the snowmobile, switch ammo clips. But I don't know. What can I tell you? And that's how this minute ends. Did you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get
Oh.
into the script?
No, I mean, listen, this is just it's a minute of jet ski
That's
or
right.
snowmobiles.
That's right.
I love it.
And the
Give me
script
more.
is 4 lines of snowmobiles. It says a wide shot. John is coming up to the rear of the other vehicles. A big bounce over a mogul. I don't know what that is. MOGUL. Do you have any idea what that is? No clue. As the mobile, it doesn't even say snowmobile. It says as the mobile. It's like has an apostrophe, MOBILE. As the mobile settles, McLean pulls the rifle forward. He steadies it alongside the windshield of the snowmobile. And that's it. That's all we get for this minute from the script.
It's an easy chapter to talk about. I'm very happy.
Every chapter is easy to talk about. Come on. There's always something to talk about here. We just proved it. Come on. We
Yeah.
had one.
Yeah, we just had a chase scene for a minute and
That's
we got a
right.
lot out
That's
of it.
true. So every Tuesday, I have a segment called Disaster Tuesday, where what I've tried to do is try and find some interesting plane crashes that have happened to famous people over the years, and discuss the stories of what happened to them, stuff like that. And what I try to do is try and find something that has somewhat of a connection to my guest. All right, so the one that we're going to discuss this week is a plane crash that happened in Leesburg, Florida. Do you have any idea where Leesburg, Florida is? I know you grew up in Florida, and you're in Atlanta, so you're not that far from it.
I don't know.
All right, so this plane crash happened on March 18th, 1982, and it happened to a very famous musical band.
Okay.
It's about Ozzy Osbourne's band. Have you ever heard this story about what happened?
No. Let's hear it.
On March 18th, 1982, Ozzy Osbourne and his band played in Knoxville Civic Coliseum, and they were heading to a festival in Orlando called the Rock Super Bowl number 14. Basically, their bus was having problems with the air conditioning unit, so they stopped in a place in Leesburg, Florida, okay, which was known as the Flying Baron Estates. All right, now Ozzy Osbourne was asleep in the bus while it was getting fixed. And one of the guys in the band, the bus driver, name was Andrew Aycock. Okay, so while they were waiting to get the air conditioning fixed, he decided that since the place that they were at, it was a property owned by the Calhoun Brothers Tour Bus Company, and they had an airstrip there with helicopters and small planes. So Andrew Aycock decided he had a plane license, And he decided to basically steal a Beechcraft plane, take it up for a joyride. So on the first flight, he took keyboardist Don Airey with him and the tour manager Jake Duncan. They were there up with him. And Aycock decided while he was flying that he was going to buzz the bus in an attempt to wake up the drummer, Tommy Aldridge. So he buzzed the bus a few times and then landed. Then
Wow.
he decided he was going to go up again. And this time he decided he was going to take up Randy Rhodes, and who was what was Randy Rhodes? So he was a guitarist, and Rachel Youngblood, who was the makeup artist. Now Rhodes himself was actually afraid of flying and didn't want to get in the plane, but he was convinced that he can take some great aerial photos of the countryside if he does that. They tried to coax bassist Rudy Sarzo also to join him, but he decided that he'd rather go back to sleep and get more sleep on the bus. So the second flight they took off, and they buzzed the tour bus numerous times, and they had two very close passes, and on the third pass they actually botched it, and one of the plane's wings clipped the top of the tour bus, and it broke the wing into two, and the plane spiraled out of control. And basically hit a tree and then crashed into a nearby mansion, and it burst into flames, killing all three of
Oh.
them. Rhodes actually the night before was got into an argument about the fact that he was drinking a lot, and basically Ozzy, I think it was Ozzy Osbourne, said to him that you're going to kill yourself one of these days, not knowing that it was the next day. That was what was going to happen to him, that he was going to get into this
Jeez
to
Louise.
this crazy. I mean, come on, think about it. We're talking about a plane crash because the guy hit a bus. Unbelievable. So it woke up Sharon Osbourne, who was sleeping on the bus, and she's quoted as saying that there were body parts all over the place from this crash. Don Airey, the keyboardist, was actually the only member of the band who actually witnessed it, because everyone else was basically sleeping. And he was basically taking pictures of the plane that he was going to give to Rhodes to show him, Rhodes was taking pictures from the plane, he was taking pictures of the plane, stuff like that. They claimed the plane itself was nearly perpendicular, about 6 feet off the ground at one point, and that it then clipped the bus and crashed into the tree. Which is just crazy.
What a maniac.
Yeah,
He
seriously.
took others with him.
I mean, there's a strong suspicion that he was high at the time, the driver, the pilot, Aycock. So I mean, the whole thing's just completely nuts about how that whole thing happened. And I mean, there are rumors that they say that it wasn't necessarily an accident, that it was something that he wanted to do, because apparently his estranged ex-wife was there, and he was possibly aiming the plane at her to try and hit her.
Whoa.
No, nobody really knows. And Don Airey claims that it's that he thinks he saw that there was a fight going on in the cockpit between Rhodes and Aycox. Maybe Aycox was saying, "I'm going to go kill her," and he was trying to stop him or something like that. So we have absolutely no idea. They think that maybe Rhodes was able to change the trajectory of the plane so that it wouldn't hit the bus directly or something like that. I mean, again, this is just a crazy story.
Crazy
It's one of the
story.
things that just shouldn't have happened. That's what it comes down to.
No.
Sometimes you have plane accidents that there's nothing you can do about them, but this one for sure. But I saved it for you because I knew you'd love these crazy, crazy stories that happened in Florida.
Sounds about right. I mean, that's a Tuesday, and you're doing this on a Tuesday, so it makes
That's
sense.
right. It's very true. Very true. All right, Mark, do you want to tell people once again where they can find Mark Hoffmeyer?
Movies, films, and flicks, Deep Blue Sea, the podcast, and then just my other stuff that's around. You can find me.
All right, great. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe to any podcast you might be using to listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. You can find me on Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay!
Yippee-ki-yay.
If you're fond of sand dunes, bones and salty air. Quaint little villages here.